Cassatt Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to Season 3 of Cassatt Conversations. I am your host, Heather Haslam. This season, we will explore the weighty topic of health equity. Within each conversation, we will discover insights from researchers, practitioners, and experts on this complex and important topic. We hope you enjoy today's conversation. On today's episode, we are excited to welcome Dr. Eloisa Gordon-Mora. Dr. Mora is the University Diversity and Inclusion Officer at the University of Nevada, Reno. Welcome, Eloisa. We are so happy to have you here today.
It is my great honor. Thank you so much, Heather, for the invitation. Looking forward to our conversation.
Me too. So as we get started, I'd love for you to tell us a little bit about yourself and what inspires you to commit time and effort and resources to health equity.
Yes, I'm a political scientist by training, and my research and my focus has always been on democratic theory, critical culture theory, community organizing, and post-colonial literature. So therefore, with that focus on democracy, healthcare is such a fundamental element of a healthy, equitable, and democratic society that even though my sphere of expertise is not healthcare itself, is so much the way I understand it, part of what a robust democratic society ought to be. As a political scientist, I also always describe myself as an activist political scientist, meaning that I have balanced academic, intellectual research work with community organizing. For instance, I worked 10 years in New York City, and I was focused on work with poor women, children, and mostly African-American, Latinx, Asian, LGBTQ plus populations living in poverty, homeless populations. So firsthand, I had to experience the inequities that do exist in our society for certain groups. Also, before that, I was dean, before my current position as UNR's Diversity and Inclusion Officer, I was dean of social science in Puerto Rico. And I was at a university that really served a good number of our student population, were first generation students coming from either low-income or recent immigrant communities. And the well-being of students is so impacted by other things besides what's learned in the classroom. And there, I also experienced the lack of access of certain groups, for instance, trans groups, recent immigrant groups, undocumented groups, poor sectors overall to healthcare. And therefore, how, for me as a political scientist, focus on democracy impacts the fuller possible participation of larger sectors of society into the democratic project.
And what drew you to become a political scientist?
That's a good question. And, you know, usually people have some type of moment in their lives that kind of defines that choice. Maybe out of the experience of being Puerto Rican, I am Puerto Rican, and in Puerto Rico, unlike I think in the United States, politics is such an everyday part of the ordinary citizen because of our relationship with the United States, unresolved relationship of a territory, of a colony. That's so much part of our everyday lives. So I think that as a Puerto Rican, I was kind of immediately drawn to the idea of politics and what is a good society. Puerto Rico is still greatly a poor society. Almost 46% of the total population fall under federal definitions of poverty. So the issues of marginalization, discrimination were kind of my everyday existence as a Puerto Rican. And then, as I mentioned, I worked for many years in New York City, which is just sort of in quintessential, up to a recent time, Puerto Rican neighborhood in the United States. Now, there are so many Puerto Ricans in the United States that Florida perhaps is now the quintessential neighborhood, Puerto Rican neighborhood. But for instance, my years in El Barrio, that is East Harlem, that Puerto Rican quintessential neighborhood that I mentioned, was traditionally a poor neighborhood. And for instance, talking about healthcare was considered for a long time the neighborhood with the highest incidence of asthma in all of New York State, and essentially a Puerto Rican neighborhood. And asthma is so prevalent among Puerto Ricans that there are even epidemiological studies that speak of a Puerto Rican syndrome, you know, the certain characteristics that asthma has within the Puerto Rican neighborhood. So again, a real life kind of experience that connected me to my engagement with political science, with democracy, and in this case, with how health issues are not universally experienced, but have to do a lot with geography, with identity, with access to resources, with incorporation into the societal offerings.
Yeah, it sounds like it's really been part of the fiber of your being throughout your entire life.
It is. And even for this job as diversity, equity, inclusion, I feel the same. For me, diversity, equity, inclusion, social justice are the tools of democracy. So therefore, somebody who is so interested in the idea and the advancement of democracy has to be involved in issues of diversity, equity, inclusion, social justice.
So as you speak of, you know, the tools of democracy and the advancement of democracy, I'd love for you to start by just sharing with us really what is your definition of democracy?
That is always a question that I say, that if there is an elusive term, a democracy is one of those, because folks tend to think that they know what democracy is, and it's a commonly used term, especially now in the most recent United States experience of challenges to its understanding of democracy. We hear about democracy often, but I would bet that most people would be hard-pressed to give a definition to what is democracy. And that's part of the elusiveness and the challenges of the notion. And we can go back to the Greeks, who originated the term democracy in the 5th and 6th century before the Christian era. And the word democracy comes from two terms in Greek: demos, which is the people, and kratos, which is authority or power. So democracy as a notion from millennial old Greek definitions is meant to be power of the people. And that's what folks tend to think of democracy. But immediately off the bat, I would say, then we would have to challenge who are the people? Because the process of democracy has been most certainly a process of gradual incorporation of different sectors of what we call the people. Even with the Greek origins, those that were part of the democratic understanding were only male, educated, some levels of worth, adults who were considered valid members of the polis, and the polis being the political society. So therefore, from the very origins of the Greek conception of democracy, which is what most Western societies follow as a model, that kind of foundation of being for the benefit of male adults, educated, some level of wealth, was created. And honestly, that has been the experience of most societies, if not all, in their evolution to democracy. So democracy is never completely universally defined, there are constructions in political science that, for instance, speak of a minimalist definition of democracy and a maximalist definition of democracy. Many times, many folks in the United States tend to follow, when they think of democracy, a minimalist definition, and by that it means the reality of a competitive, pluralist electoral process. People tend to think that's mostly what democracy is about. And most certainly, that's one of the elements of democracy. But even if you were to follow the minimalist definition, you would have to ask, who has been historically allowed to vote, even if you think that's only democracy? And we know, focusing on the U.S. experience, that process has historically been at the exclusion of African American, Blacks, Indigenous communities, poor sectors, and even white women receive something as basic as the right to vote later than other Western societies. For instance, Finland established the vote for women in 1906, almost 20 years before the United States, as well as Australia, Denmark, Canada. So again, if we are to define democracy, it's, among other things, in terms of the reality and its true-to-life experience, a process of incorporation into that idea of the people. And then, because of that process, is that we move into what's called in political science maximalist definitions of democracy. And that is more better understanding that beyond the electoral process, there are aspects of social existence that can be procedural, such as the rule of law, participation, really establishing broad participation in public decision-making, accountability, and all these things we know have been challenged in the recent United States experience, even in electoral procedures, but also questions of civil liberties, economic rights, political rights, equality. And that's where we move more into the more maximalist definition of democracy, and healthcare would follow clearly on those definitions. But something, again, to keep in mind, because all democracies are not the same, United States historically has endorsed the idea of civil and political liberties, but has been reluctant to endorse social, economic, cultural rights. For instance, the United States is signatory to the UN Covenant on Political and Civil Rights, but not to the one of economic, social, and cultural rights. And that's when then we begin to see the difference in healthcare provisioning. For instance, the Scandinavian countries that offer universal healthcare, universal K-18 educational access and all that, that's when we begin to see the differences in healthcare provisioning as a measure of democracy and as a measure of equality and equity.
Yeah, I'm really struck by the complexity of it all. And
Correct.
Yeah, even just thinking about, you know, how you started talking about democracy being this elusive term and our understanding of it, you know, I'm sure varies across listeners.
And that's why, you know, as an educator, I always point out that the important for me purpose of any educational effort, but most certainly higher education, should be not only to train on professional skills that are very much individual needs that have to be addressed, but to teach and educate on democracy. Because the complexity that you point out points out to the fact that democracy is not something you innately know. Mm-hmm. You know, a phrase of one of my mentors in political science is that Democrats, meaning people who believe in democracy, are not born, they're made. Mm-hmm. You have to be educated into believing in democracy. And what we have seen in the world recently is that that actually is a not share value and commitment and understanding throughout the world. Mm-hmm. And in our nation.
Well, and you also spoke about, to me, it's like a spectrum of democracy, it sounds depending on what country and what measures. So can you share with us some of the measures of democracy?
Yes. Sometime when we spoke, Heather, I had mentioned that something I follow as a source of research and data is this world unit or world organization that measures democracy called the Economist Intelligence Unit. And they're a nonprofit that measures democracies and understanding of democracy throughout the world. And they use five basic indicators, and those are electoral process and pluralism, meaning how often does a nation have competitive elections? Are they truly competitive? Are they open? Are they pluralist? The functioning of government, and we'll see in the case of the United States, that's an important one, meaning is government efficient? Is it overly bureaucratic? Does it serve population at large? Does it serve different interests? Political participation. And again, we know that in the United States, unlike other countries, that's not an important element of our democracy. Political participation in the United States historically has been under standard of other countries, where you have 80% participation. For instance, in Puerto Rico, I told you that politics is very important, 80-something participation. So that's also in itself a measure of why is this a disengagement from almost half of the population typically. You know, the political participation rates in the United States are usually around 50-something percent, except in the most recent election where it really went up given the circumstances we have been living. But that speaks then of that kind of lack of commitment or active commitment to the idea of democracy. So that's the third. And fourth is democratic political culture. And that's actually an area in my work that I'm very much invested because, as I was saying earlier, a commitment to democracy is the result of education and therefore the result of fomenting certain values. In order to advance democracy, you have to believe in democracy. So therefore, that speaks of the existence of certain values that support or not the idea of democracy, and values do not necessarily are good things in themselves. You know, you can have values that support authoritarian systems, and we see that throughout the world. And finally, civil liberties. So the EIU, using research coming from such places as the Pew Center, the World Bank, and other really recognized research institutes, the World Values Survey, another important source, follows these five measures. And the importance of those measures is that if we say that the idea of democracy can be elusive and abstract, those five are measurable realities. You can establish what is the regularity of an electoral process, what is the level of participation, what is the type of political culture. So that's why it's, I think, such a useful instrument that is used worldwide. And importantly, in terms of their findings, and again, maybe going, as you were mentioning, against our common sense, since the index, the EIU index, was created in 2006, it has established a number of findings. Number one is that only a fraction of the world lives under what they categorize as full democracy. Only 8.4% of the world in the last index of 2021 live under what you would call full democracy. As opposed to that, one third of the world lives under authoritarian regimes. So, and then in between that, the four classifications are full democracies, flawed democracies, hybrid regimes, and authoritarian regimes. So it says something that we think that democracy is such a commonly experienced notion, such a modern reality, and actually is the rarity, even in the 21st century. Most people live in authoritarian regimes, in hybrid regimes that usually refer to highly corrupt, highly irregular societies, or flawed democracies that refer to kind of weakened aspects of those four, five measures of democracy.
And so where does the United States rank?
What do you think? Out of the four.
I mean, as I listen, I think, well, we're probably in flawed democracy would be
very good. And, you know, I say very good because it, when I always ask that question, most people are kind of shocked by that. And again, what's important of this finding is that it's not a propaganda ideological kind of comment, but it's based on certain measurable realities that democracy should have. Importantly, in terms of the United States, that category of flawed democracy has been ascribed to the United States in over 10 years. So something to reflect upon is that, you know, a democracy is not simply what political party is in power. It's because, you know, the United States has been classified as such when different political parties have been in power. The measures that the EIU follows, which are the measures that any political scientist would follow, are more substantial structural realities. So therefore, what those, that classification of flawed democracy points to is that there are structures in the U.S. Experience, meaning procedures, regulations, practices, that result in that flaw category. And other flawed democracies that the United States would join forces with, so you have an idea of what nations we're talking about in terms of Western nations, it would be France, Italy, Portugal, and ironically, Greece, the originator of democracy. So what would be full democracies? And those are societies in which those five measures of democracy are robustly manifested. Top of the list, Finland. No, Norway. Norway is has been consistently number one. So I would say, maybe we should move to Norway. Norway consistently has been for many years number one, followed by Finland, Sweden, Iceland, and Denmark. So a comment to make about that is that, as you know, those are all Scandinavian countries that follow historically, at least, even though there have been recent fluctuation, a form of government that that is highly supportive of not only economic and political rights, I'm sorry, political and civil rights, but also economic, social, and cultural rights. It's a system of government that normally is described as a social democratic government. So therefore, a form of democracy that really embraces the idea of supporting collective and different groups. For instance, in this society, there's such thing as a right to work that we don't have. There's universal health care, as I mentioned. There's universal access to education, K-18, etc. But also importantly, and then as a comment to how democracy is ought to be understood as always a work in progress and something that we cannot let go, but that we have to consistently engage with, is that following that list of the Scandinavian countries, the next one is Ireland. And why that is a significant finding is that Ireland, way ahead in the list from the UK, from Great Britain, has achieved a status of full democracy. UK also classifies as a full democracy, but in a, you know, lower range than Ireland. So Ireland, a society that has had recent history of political violence under the domination of Great Britain for many centuries, history of social inequities and poverty for a long time out of an active involvement in advancing democracy has reached this category. And something also to remember about Ireland, unlike the United States, is that despite its Catholic possible limitations to certain practices of inclusion, Ireland has had two female presidents, Mary McLeish and Mary Robinson, even before the United States has reached that possibility of inclusion. So other full democracies, and I'll just read the list. I mentioned some of them in the Western Hemisphere, but for instance, in Asia and Australia, full democracies are New Zealand, Australia, and Japan. In Latin America, Uruguay, and Costa Rica. And in sub-Saharan Africa, that we also tend to think not a democratic context, Mauritius is a full democracy. So above even the United States, and I'll kind of end by saying that things to learn, because democracy is always an educational process, so we also should learn from other examples. Even though it was an English colony, a plantation economy from early 19th century until 1968, when it achieved its independence, now it's ranked as the most peaceful African country by the Global Peace Index, a high income economy by the World Bank, and having very high classifications of human development, of human well-being index, such as social welfare, universal health care, free education K-18, free public transportation for students, seniors, and disabled citizens. So again, pointing to, with all these examples, what are the characteristics of full democracy and how we can also maybe learn what are the characteristics of a more robust healthcare system.
Yeah. I'm really struck by the term human well-being. And that to me is like, oh, that's what I would like that we move towards.
Exactly.
And that's how it's connected with, yeah, health equity. You mentioned
I was just going to add that something that very fortunately, because moments of crisis can be also moments of possibilities, I think that because of the crisis we have been living in the United States and in the globe recently, but taking the example of the United States, we now begin to hear more folks speaking of happiness as a human right. And that's, you know, there are measures to happiness, as you're saying, that have to do with human well-being. And a sick person, for instance, cannot be happy. So there's way of achieving something that could also be elusive. What is happiness? Mm-hmm. but there are indicators that can advance that. Sorry to interrupt.
No, you're good. I'm curious, you mentioned that this index really started in 2006. And so I'm curious if the United States has ranked differently, you know, from 2006, you know, has it moved on the rankings in any certain direction? Has it always kind of been in the same spot?
Well, from this ranking, because there are other measures and indexes that exist in the world, the United States tendency has been, unfortunately, to decrease its ranking within that flaw democracy spectrum. And as you say, democracies are, and you very well point out, also a spectrum of achievements. You know, I must say that there were lower scores overall for US within that took place within the last administration, and for issues we well know what those were about, and even impacting basic democratic measures as transparency in the electoral process, etc. But significantly in this new most recent election, because participation improved for the United States, the numbers ended up being somewhat better.
Okay. Super interesting.
But still within that flaw spectrum that is shared by other Western societies that I mentioned.
And you mentioned that there, in order to have democracy, there are certain values that need to be in place or believed in. So can you name some of those values for us?
Well, I think that because there's no universal definition of democracy, you know, there are many, and the whole theory of democratic evolutions, you know, would address that, that democracy in a way is also contextual. There are certain historical realities that lend themselves more or not to to certain values connected to democracy and or not. And as I mentioned, historically, and we can go to the foundation of the United States nations, the idea of civil and political liberties as values have been very strongly inscribed in the United States experience of what is a democracy. If we take the example of the Scandinavian countries, where unlike most Western European nations, unlike the American experience, were societies that were not colonial powers, did not participate in slave trade, did not participate in conquest, in the subjugation of indigenous populations. So there has been some like historical almost benefit that those societies has had to create more of a sense of collective shared experience and less dramatic moments of clear discrimination, clear oppression, which are the challenges of so many societies. So what I'm trying to say is that I would not say that there are values that democracy can be universally established to have, but if we follow the five measures of something like the EIU, those are the values that those five measures also suggest values. You know, something like political participation must have the value of inclusion. Something like electoral process and pluralism must have the value of equity, accountability, transparency. But something as a political culture that endorses economic, social, and cultural rights must have values of that connect the idea of not having such social class differentiations that we have in the society, of creating, which is the way it's done in social democratic societies, a tax system that prevents those very extreme polarization of wealth that we are now experiencing, that I would say it's a challenge to democracy because it creates real life obstacles to participation to good sectors of society that are so consuming their own survival that then democracy does become more the engagement of political elites, which is a challenge also of current US democracies. And part of the disengagement, I would say, even folks in the left and the right, is that they don't see a level of genuine participation and in the process. So you know, what I'm trying to say is that we can identify maybe the values for certain forms of democracy. And ideally, we would like to think that most folks would want to advance all the possibilities of democracy, but unfortunately, that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah. So how does democracy impact health?
So if we accept the fact that, at least from measurable, verifiable sources, U.S. is a flawed democracy at this moment, that implies for me that its provisioning of healthcare is also flawed. And if we look at more specific evidence for that, and I'll share some information with you. We know from data that healthcare access, delivery, quality of care is not equally experienced by all societal sectors. There's widespread evidence documenting how those possibilities are adversely experienced by Black American sectors, by Indigenous Americans, by people of color, immigrant, undocumented communities, and poor communities in general. Because there's not such thing as a universal, not privately provided healthcare in the United States. Access to healthcare, among other things, implies access to a certain income. So off the bat, there's a level of unequal participation and benefit and unequal experiences of quality healthcare, of the type of treatments that you can that you might need, but that you might or might not be able to receive the medication, et cetera. So from data, we know that the United States has high rates of illness and death among certain areas such as diabetes, hypertension, obesity, asthma, heart disease, and that folks of color tends to be impacted by those more than white sectors. Compared to whites, racial and ethnic minorities, poor sectors are less likely to receive, as I mentioned, preventive health services, which therefore lead the way to illness, and usually receive, as we know, even commonsensically, lower quality of care. In terms of, again, kind of measuring healthcare, and to speak with this about this from data and evidence, a source I always use is something called the Commonwealth Fund, which, similar to the EIU, and maybe you're familiar with it, measures healthcare throughout the globe. And again, they base their research on such highly recognized sources as the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the World Bank, and so forth. And again, similar to the EIU, and as an academic, I think it's important that we approach these discussions from evidence. The Commonwealth also follows certain measures to establish what is the status of healthcare. And again, unfortunately, and parallel to its standing in democratic classifications, the out of five measures that they use that I will discuss, the U.S. rank the lowest in four of them when compared to other high-income developed nations, so comparable societies. And those measures are access to care. That means affordability, timeliness. We know that especially after the pandemic, you know, you can wait a long time to achieve care, but that has been the reality of sectors of society that either do not have a level of income, that come from underserved communities, et cetera. So that's the first measure, access to care. Administrative efficiency. And by that, what that refers to is what is the level of paperwork, bureaucracy, complications that are entailed to access treatment, and how those negatively impact, if it's too burdensome and cumbersome, as we know is our system, how does that impact the willingness even of patients to want to continue. The other measure is healthcare outcomes. Of course, out of that access to care, that administrative efficiency, how much of society's sick, ill population, how much is it actually serving? And that can be measured. And fourth measure is equity, which brings all of those measures together. So the United States ranks below most develop high-income societies in those four: access to care, administrative efficiency, equity, and healthcare outcomes. Yet the fifth one, which for me was surprising, which is care process, which generally refers to preventive care, the U.S. ranks fairly high on that. However, we have to understand that these are aggregated measures. What the Commonwealth Fund is measuring is how society as a whole is serving its general population. So even in this last measure, if we begin to disaggregate preventive care by ethnic, racial, income, LGBTQ plus, trans population, we know that then those outcomes are not the same. So again, in terms of classification, and I give this listing because there ought to be lessons learned from the example. Again, Norway scores the highest in healthcare provisioning and in democratic classification. And in decreasing order, the Netherlands, Australia, United Kingdom, Germany, New Zealand, Sweden, France, Switzerland, Canada, and after all of those, United States.
So I'm curious, what are some of the lessons that we can learn from the countries that do have a more collective approach to well-being?
I think that the issue that you bring up about values, even though it might be difficult and elusive, is an important one. So many of the issues that we're discussing really are premised on educational pursuits. We need to educate on what could be a better democratic society, what could be a better healthcare system. And there's a lot of, as we know, one of the unfortunate terms that we hear now all the time is misinformation, false information. There's a lot of untruth around what are the possibilities of democracy, as well as what are the possibilities of a more equitable, precisely a more democratic healthcare system. And one of them, those falsities cost something that it's extremely important out of this findings is that even though the United States ranks below other comparable Western developed societies in four of the five measures I mentioned, it actually spends more of its gross domestic product than most of those nations. One thing that has been used as a counter falsity source of information for something like universal care is that it would be costly and in addition to taxes. And what we can learn from these nations is that's not the case. That even though United States is already spending more of its gross domestic product on healthcare, it's not being administratively efficient in the use of those funds. And that's one of the measures that the United States does poorly. And by that means, all the cumbersome bureaucracy, and meaning all the expenses that paying all those people entail, more equitable systems are more immediate. You don't have to traverse all these procedures and paperwork. Also, other more equitable system are supported by public funding as opposed to private insurance companies. So therefore, the taxes are more immediately used to what ought to be the priority, which is the well-being of patients. As we know, in the system that we share, because it's privately managed through insurance company, in reality, I would say the priority is the insurance company bottom line. And therefore, what is positive about all these reflections is that we don't need to be stuck with the imperfect system, with the inequitable system that we have, but we can think and learn of how is it that other comparable Western capitalist societies, all of them are that, do it in a more efficient way.
I'm remembering I had a political science teacher who shared that, and I don't know if this is still true, but that the only two unregulated entities, I don't know if that's not the right word, in the United States were baseball and insurance. Because we were talking about the cost of insurance. And so you have, you know, essentially 51 different systems all working that are not regulated by the federal government, which is just really interesting that those were the two that he shared.
Yeah. And, you know, and I think that, again, because political culture beliefs are important in supporting a type of democratic system or other, in the United States, we have to recognize that the understanding of a good society as very individualistic base is a strong belief. We in the United States still have to believe on those notions as pulling yourself by the bootstraps and that everybody can do it. And we need to continue educating on the evidence-based realities that that's not the case for all groups. And through that kind of consistent messaging, understanding that the reason why we create government, actually, and political society is that we need to organize the collective. You know, actually, if we lived each of us in an isolated island, then we could only worry about our individual concerns. But as participants of society, whether we want to believe it or not, we have to work in the benefit of the group. And I think that's an understanding that is more challenging in the United States than in other societies. Even societies like France, Spain, Italy, they have a more collective tradition. For instance, union organizing in those societies, not a crime. it's a right of workers. And other aspects of collective well-being are less of a challenge than maybe in the Anglo-Saxon tradition. But, you know, importantly, even though we inherited those political beliefs from Great Britain, even Great Britain has absorbed more of that collectivist approach. Why? Because they understand that the benefit, what benefits the society, has to be thought from the groups.
Yeah, and how do we shift to more of you've talked about the importance of education, and we have a lot of misinformation, and people get bristled with fear with change, and so I'm just really curious your thoughts on how do we move the needle as we really are in this individualistic society to more of a collective society.
Well, you know, I would not even say that we should move to a more collectivistic society, because I know that would scare the heck out of a lot of people, because it's misassociated with other notions that that's not what the goal ought to be. But more a more consistent and active and pervasive and persistent educational process of understanding that there are areas of human existence that are by nature collective. The educational system is a collective experience. You know, you cannot benefit individual students. You have to benefit group of students. And we have to continue pushing those understanding in areas such as healthcare, that in this society, as you well know, as an expert on this matters, is a highly contentious area of understanding. That, you know, is that understanding that precisely because you want to advance your individual interests, it has to be as part of a group effort, because that's the way it's actually going to move ahead. Mm-hmm. These are times of, as we know, for the United States, for the globe, of enormous level of crisis, levels of disengagement, of disappointment, of cynicism. But The answer is that also crisis can open. It doesn't happen all the time, but can open possibilities because we have in crisis proven that certain things are not working. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it ought to invite to the possibility of rethinking alternatives. And, you know, ironically, the United States is still a young nation when we think of Greece, for instance, and other examples. So you would think that that spirit that has been so much part also of the American experience of innovation and the idea of constant evolution, that we should in a way go back to those beliefs in a more democratic direction, that we don't need to be stuck in the place that we are and that that's not all that there is. Yeah. And that is actually a very American way of thinking. Mm-hmm. So it's also to, you know, we have that mentality for entrepreneurial business proposition. So let's also open ourselves to innovation, creativity, possibilities in other areas of human existence.
Yeah, and I come from a human development background. And so I love how you talk about how the United States is a young nation. And so that actually gives me hope that as we continue to age, that hopefully we can develop some wisdom as we reflect on where we are today. And is it time to, you know, pivot in other directions or really go back to some of our values that we were founded on?
Yeah. And the idea and the reality of democracy has to be participatory. That's one of the actual measures of it. And by that, I mean not simply participating in electoral procedures, but being an active citizen. Mm-hmm. That's where the strength of the people, if we go back to that original notion, actually lies. Mm-hmm.
Well, you've given us a lot to think about today. My mind goes in a million directions as you share so much. I feel like we could, I can learn so much from you. So as we wrap up today, is there anything else that you feel is important for our listeners to know?
I would say just underlining what we have been saying, the importance of the educational process. And by that, I don't mean simply higher education. I mean all educational outlets. As active citizens, we should more actively participate in discussions, in groups. You know, if we go back to Alexis Tocqueville, which was one of the great commentators of the American experience in the 19th century, what he thought was such a important characteristic of democratic possibilities of the American experience was that town hall gathering, those type of smaller groups. And by that he meant, and of course we live in a virtual era now, so it's not like we can easily replicate that. But what he meant is the idea of groups discussing, of groups reflecting, of groups proposing. Mm-hmm. That for him was one of the important foundations of what could be the democratic experience for the United States and for other nations. So to really embrace that is really accessible to any of us. And also something I always say to my students that political arrangements are human created arrangements. So therefore, there's no law of gravity about them that cannot be changed. The same way that what we have now is a result of human intervention, we can also intervene to create something better.
I love that. I've been working a lot with first responders recently, and they do AAR, so after action reviews. And so after yes. an incident occurs, then coming together as a group and discussing how it went, yes. what went well, what needs to be changed, and then reflecting on how to move forward for the future. And so that strikes me from that town hall perspective and that coming together as groups for how are we doing?
Exactly. And of course, acting upon those reflections.
That's another critical piece, right? Sometimes yeah. we're really good at talking about
that's
things.
That's really where you're crossing the bridge.
Take action.
Yes.
Well, Eloisa, it has been a joy to talk with you today and learn from you. You just have a wealth of knowledge and really grateful for your time.
Thank you so much. You have made it so easy. I was a bit nervous at the beginning, but it really was a great conversation. Thank you so much, Heather.
Thank you.
And thank you to the audience.
Thank you for listening to CASAT Conversations, your resource for exploring behavioral health topics. We hope you found today's conversation timely and meaningful. Please share this podcast with your friends and colleagues. If you want to learn more, visit us at our blog at casatondemand.org.
CASAT Podcast Network. This podcast has been brought to you by the CASAT Podcast Network, located within the Center for the Application of Substance Abuse Technologies at the University of Nevada, Reno. For more podcast information and resources, visit casat.org.